How to follow health and safety guidelines. In this section, we'll look at why you should follow approved methods and procedures when you carry out potentially hazardous activities. We'll look at the importance of how you should follow health and safety guidelines, and how you should support others to do the same. There are many situations in which you are required to follow guidelines. We'll examine five. 1. Moving and handling. 2. Cross-infection. 3. Food preparation. 4. Lone working or independent working. And 5. Water temperatures. Moving and handling. Each year, an estimated 428,000 people in Britain suffer from back problems, which they attribute to manual handling activities at work. Disorders affecting the back may cost Britain £3 billion per year. In the social and healthcare sector, almost 50% of accidents each year involve manual handling, in particular assisting people with mobility. It's not possible to provide complete instructions in this chapter for the safe moving and handling of individuals and heavy objects in care settings. However, the subject deserves close attention due to the potential risk it poses both to workers and those for whom they care. Employers now have a duty to train all staff required to undertake these duties. You should not attempt to lift heavy objects or individuals unless you've been fully trained. Back injury amongst nursing and care workers is one of the most common reasons for time off work. Individuals who do not receive proper care when they need assistance to move can be seriously affected in relation to their recovery, rehabilitation, or general health and well-being. The Manual Handling Operations Regulations were introduced in 1992 and amended in 2002. They outline clear practices that have to be put in place. Responsibilities of employers. Employers have a duty to ensure the safety of all employees involved in manual handling and moving. Employers have the responsibility to make a thorough assessment and implement measures to avoid risk or minimise it to the greatest possible degree, including the provision of appropriate training. Employers have a duty to ensure the safety of lifting equipment, which should be inspected every 6 months, and to provide training in its use. Responsibilities of employees. Employees have the responsibility to obey reasonable and lawful instructions in relation to moving and handling, and to act with reasonable care and skill. Employees have a duty to attend health and safety training as required by their employer, and to avoid or minimise risk to the greatest possible degree. Employees have a duty to attend training in relation to the use of lifting equipment, to use lifting aids as directed, and to report any faults that they find in equipment. More comprehensive guidance can be found in the HSE 2006 leaflet Getting to Grips with Manual Handling, a short guide. Using moving and handling equipment when required is an essential part of providing a safe environment. You should always encourage everyone you work with to do likewise, and report any poor practice you witness. If the equipment you are asked to use is broken or faulty, you must report this immediately. Cross-infection. The subject of cross-infection, especially MRSA and C. difficile, has been discussed earlier in this paper. In many care settings, vulnerable children, adults and older adults are cared for, and the risk of infection to them may have serious consequences. Procedures to minimise the risk of cross-infection are often referred to as standard infection control procedures, with the word standard meaning that they are used when dealing with all individuals at all times. This, in effect, protects all individuals and all staffs from cross-infection from each other. Remember Verinda, who had HIV and hepatitis B and who did not want everyone to know? We did say that the worker would have to inform her line manager but not other staff, as they should be using standard procedures when dealing with all individuals they support, and not just the ones that they know or suspect of having an infectious disease. This not only protects everyone on a health basis, but also protects the confidentiality of the individual and prevents workers from being discriminatory towards certain individuals. So what are these standard infection control procedures? These procedures cover a very wide range of procedures, but three main areas are considered here. 1. Hand washing. 2. Gloves. And 3. Protective clothing. Hand washing. The government, the Care Commission, the British Medical Association and the Royal College of Nursing have all highlighted hand washing as a major factor in the battle against cross-infection. Not only do they give advice to nurses, care workers, doctors and ancillary staff about how to wash hands, but also when to do it. Try listing when you should wash your hands. Here's my first list. Remember that this applies even when you're wearing gloves. Hand hygiene should be applied at the very beginning of every shift, before all contact with individuals when undertaking personal care or medical procedures, after all contact with individuals when undertaking personal care or medical procedures, after exposure to body fluids, after handling soiled linen, incontinence pads, sanitary products and so on, after you cough, sneeze or blow your nose, at the end of every shift, and if in any doubt. You must wash your hands thoroughly. Any cuts or abrasions should be covered with the appropriate plasters or dressings. Hospitals now have a hand gel available that all staff and visitors are asked to use. It's also recommended that staff should have short, clean nails and that rings and other jewellery should be removed as they harbour germs. Gloves. Wearing gloves is a crucial factor in minimising the risk of cross-infection, but it must be remembered that the use of gloves does not reduce the need to wash your hands. Small puncture holes may not be noticed, and the warm, moist atmosphere created by the gloves provides a perfect environment in which germs can grow and multiply. Gloves should be damage-free, seamless, single-use, and made from latex or vinyl, and importantly, should be the correct size. Gloves should always be worn whenever you have contact with any body fluid. Feces, urine, sperm, blood, mucus, sputum, spit, sweat or vomit. Or when you're in contact with any area of the skin which has a rash or is broken or bleeding. When removing gloves, do not touch your wrists or hand with the dirty gloves. Using a gloved hand, pinch up the cuff of the other hand and pull the glove off inside out. Keep hold of the glove on the remaining gloved hand. Using the ungloved hand, insert it behind the other cuff and pull the glove off, turning it inside out. Both gloves should be folded together inside out and should be discarded immediately into the clinical waste bag. Remember to wash your hands. If there are no gloves in the dispenser, you must never carry out procedures without them. It only takes a few minutes to get a new box. More information can be found in the Care Commission Guidance 2006, Disposable Gloves, Use and Management. Protective clothing. Protective clothing usually refers to aprons, but can also mean gowns and protective glasses or face masks. As a simple guide, aprons should be worn when you're wearing gloves as outlined above. Aprons should be made of plastic and should be disposed of after each procedure in the same way as gloves. They should never be used to carry out procedures with more than one individual. When removing an apron, pull the neck band and the side, thus breaking the ties, and fold the apron in on itself to prevent the spread of germs. Discard it in a clinical waste bag, and again, Wash your hands before going to assist another individual. Food preparation. Increasingly, care workers find themselves assisting to prepare food. Following guidelines regarding food preparation and encouraging others to do the same are crucial in minimising the risk of food poisoning, caused, for example, by outbreaks of microbiological organisms such as E. coli. The Food Safety General Regulations, Department of Health 1995, documents form the basis of good practice in any catering establishment, and this includes residential homes and hospitals. If you are involved in the preparation of food, you should receive appropriate training from your employer. This training should include topics such as food handling, preparation, and storage. General rules for all food preparation are as follows. Wash hands before and after touching or preparing food. Cover cuts with brightly coloured waterproof plasters, which can be easily identified if they fall into the food. Do not touch your face and hair, smoke, spit, sneeze, eat or chew gum when handling food. Keep equipment and utensils clean. Keep food clean and covered, and handle it as little as possible. Keep lids on waste sacks and dustbins. The Food Standards Agency, FSA, provides up-to-date guidance, including the 2005 guidance, Food Law in Britain, and the 2006 booklet, Food Hygiene, A Guide for Business. Lone working and independent working. Lone working and independent working have now become much more common ways of helping people to meet their needs. The rise in the number of individuals receiving care in their own homes has escalated in the past 10 years, and this has resulted in a vast army of workers, both health and social care, now working alone to visit individuals in their own homes. This includes night visits to provide medical care, meals, and tuck-in services. Some workers are employed by organisations, whilst others are self-employed, providing a service to people managing their own budgets for care. Organisations should have clear procedures to minimise the risks to lone workers. Usually, this involves providing workers with a mobile phone or paying for work-related calls, providing a 24-hour contact number, and instructing workers to contact this number on a regular basis, for example, when they've finished a visit or dropped someone off. Workers may also be issued with an alarm. You should always follow the procedures outlined by the organisation and report any issues or worries connected with your visits to your line manager. If you're self-employed, you should ensure your safety by putting into effect measures to protect yourself. Always carry a mobile phone. Ensure that other people know where you are. Carry an alarm. Ensure that you comply with the same health and safety procedures that would apply if you were working for an employer. Water temperatures. Despite guidelines from the Department of Health as long ago as 1998, which specified safe hot water temperatures to be used in showers and baths, several cases of death and serious injury from scalding in care and nursing homes continue to be highlighted in the press. Some individuals have been fatally scalded after being lowered into a bath that had not been tested and was too hot. Appropriate thermostatic mixing valves, type 3, should be fitted to prevent water being hotter than 44 degrees centigrade in baths and showers. Workers should be trained to carry out the following procedures. Check the temperature with the thermometer before the individual gets into a bath or shower. Periodically check the temperature of the water flow, say weekly. If more hot water is required, add slowly and check the temperature with a thermometer. Carry out risk assessments on individuals to ascertain the vulnerability and capabilities of individuals to determine the level of support they require while bathing or showering. If you follow the guidelines given to you when carrying out potentially harmful procedures, you will act as a role model to your fellow workers. Remember, good practice can be copied as well as bad. Explaining to others why you're carrying out the procedure in a particular way may also help them to change the way they do things. Persistent, dangerous practice should be reported to prevent lives being put in danger.